In North Carolina, the public school system in Wake County has become a flashpoint in the ongoing debate about diversity in education. Last March, the school board voted to dismantle its school busing policy. It used socioeconomic status as a factor when assigning students to schools within the district. The 5-4 vote was in favor of placing students closer to where they live. Critics of the decision say it amounts to modern-day segregation. Tony Tata is the superintendent of Wake County Public Schools, the largest school district in North Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Leanne. It's great to be here.
You've only been on the job for a short time, right? You started on January 31st.
That's correct.
And the school board had already voted to end this busing for diversity policy before you joined. Give us a little history. What was the board's guiding motivation?
Well, the real issue is exploding growth in Wake County. We're adding 3,000 to 5,000 new students every school year, and you would have students in the school system that would be changing schools every year, 2 years. I've talked to many parents as I've visited now 29 schools in the last 19 days. So about 18 months ago, you had an election, and the frustration had reached a pitch. And so a new board was voted in on what they considered to be a mandate of stabilizing the student assignment policy.
So the student assignment policy is being rethought right now, but the board's vote prompted the last superintendent to resign, to protest it. Why did you want the job?
Well, it's a great school system. You know, we've got a good problem here. We have increasing student enrollment, which a lot of large county and large city school districts do not have. 143,000 students, 163 schools.
And are all those 163 schools, to coin a phrase, created equal?
Yes, I would say they are. And what I left out is that we have 32 magnet schools designed originally to attract suburban students into the inner city and vice versa. And we find that we're not serving our economically disadvantaged students as well as we ought to. And so that's really my charge and my challenge is to figure out how to lift those economically disadvantaged students up to the next level while still providing tremendous opportunities for the gifted and the advanced placement students that we have.
There has been a lot of attention on the decision. The NAACP has staged protest marches. U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan has called the actions troubling. The complaint's been filed with the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights. How do you respond to those who are saying that Wake County now risks segregating its schools again?
I would respond that that's simply not going to happen. The idea that we are going to wholesale throw everything out is, I think, just not the case. And we're going to find a way to make this the best school system in the country because, I mean, there's no other option. These children deserve it.
Tony Tata is the superintendent of North Carolina's Wake County Public School District. We spoke to him about the school board's decision to end its longstanding busing for diversity policy. Mr. Tata, thank you for your time.
Leanne, my pleasure.
It's difficult to describe the illustrations of Edward Gorey without using the word macabre. Death was often a subject of his drawings, and the various ways he depicted evil adults and dispatched mischievous children often provoked horror. However, his work often also provoked humor. Besides, he didn't like the word macabre. Edward Gorey died at the age of 75 in April 2000. The following year, a slim paperback was published called The Strange Case of Edward Gorey by Alexander Theroux, one of Gorey's close friends. He had few. Recently, Theroux went back to the now-out-of-print original monograph to rewrite, expand, and redesign it. It's just been published in hardcover, and Alexander Theroux is in the studio of WGBH in Boston. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here, Leanne.
Why didn't Edward Gorey like the word macabre?
I think he heard it too much. It was a word that ghoulish and macabre were kind of the Scylla and Charybdis of his life in terms of interviews. And he never really liked to talk about his work to make a paradoxical point. So it was a way of repudiating the same old subject. And he wasn't really fussy, and he was very patient with people that talked about the macabre and the ghoulish. But everybody always went through that gate when they were talking to Edward Gorey. Hmm. And I think over the years, he would have been more interested to talk about other things.
Right. Well, in a nutshell, how would you describe his illustrations to those who may not have seen them or seen, for example, the series Mystery on PBS, where his was actually the opening sort of montage that they did in, you know, Black and White in the Graveyard and so forth?
I think his particular style grew out of that kind of fascination with pen and ink drawings. You know, I remember he once told me that it was so hard to get a book published in color when he started doing things in the early 50s, that all of his books were in black and white, partially to get them published. Mm. But to answer your question, I would say they grew out of cartoons in a wonderful, fussy, kind of manneristic way. His drawing got to be more and more oblique. His subject matter was the 20s, and he always fit his drawings to that particular world, the Edwardian period. So I think I would just say manneristic cartoons of a very high variety.
Hmm. Edward Gorey wrote more than 90 books. He illustrated some 60 others. He designed sets. He won a Tony Award for his costume design for the show Dracula. His work is reproduced everywhere. It's on exhibition. Yet it seems that Edward Gorey thought his work was ephemeral, that it wasn't lasting. Did he discuss his work with you? I mean, you knew him a while. Did he ever discuss his work with you?
Just as a kind of marginal subject, I mean, if you asked him, what is behind the drawings of the Gashly Crumb Tinies, or one of his books, The Dwindling Party, which is a mysterious pop-up book, he would say, oh, I'm going to leave you to tell me. I don't even know. He loved the phrase, I don't even know.
Hmm. How did you become friends with him?
To make a long story short, I was in a bookstore and bought several of his books. And the proprietor of the bookstore told me he lived virtually around the corner, and I couldn't believe it. So I just drove over there and knocked on his door and took a photograph, and he signed some books. And then I had written some stories that I thought he might want to illustrate over the course of that year. And so it was just a question of my being a fan, in short, just knocking on his door.
Hmm. You weren't the only one to do that. I mean, he was listed in the phone book. People knew where he lived. And he seems like someone who really wasn't thrilled about answering the door to a fan, but he would.
At times, he could be very passive-aggressive, and it depended on his mood. If he was rested, he would do it. But you would see him in restaurants, see him on Cape Cod. I mean, he stood out. He was a very poor hermit. And if you were visiting him and someone knocked on the door, maybe a goth person, they seemed to always flock over there. And he would say, we've got customers. And then he would answer the door, and they'd say, I love your work, and start gushing. He would say, thank you, now what? But he was very accessible, and people would always stop by and see him.
There were many contradictions in the man. Describe a few of them.
He was in many ways very campy in the Susan Sontag sense. He could be very serious. He read every book imaginable. He had wide interest, theology, sociology. He wasn't particularly interested in politics, but there wasn't a subject that didn't really interest him. His day was filled with hoovering up as much as he could, the news, a film, listening to Mozart, one of his favorite composers, watching a movie, doing some artwork. He went his own way.
He was someone who wanted to keep up on what Erica Kane was doing on All My Children at the same time. You know,
his day was broken down into working in the morning, but he had to get to his Erica Kane show at 1 o'clock. He loved soap operas. He very rarely wasted his time. He would sew beanbag bats and beanbag figures while he watched television. But almost every night that I knew him, and I really knew him since about 1972 to about 2000, he went to the movies almost every night. And he could segue from reading a book on Wittgenstein or Anthony Trollope to watching The Golden Girls, which is a favorite TV show of his. He needed to have a lot of movement in his mind, a lot of water going over those stones of his mind.
So is there a picture that remains in your mind of your friendship with Edward Gorey?
I still see myself just sitting in his kitchen. He would say, would you like some tea? There was always a kind of melancholy tone to his voice. And he would give you some white toast with a cinnamon shaker. And that repast with Gorey was always cinnamon on white toast and a cup of tea.
Alexander Theroux wrote The Strange Case of Edward Gorey, published by Fantagraphics Books. He joined us from the studio of WGBH in Boston. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Leanne.
You can find Edward Gorey illustrations you haven't seen, including a poster for a puppet show Gorey performed in his own home, on our website, npr.org.
Borders Books and Music filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy this week and is beginning the process of closing about a third of their stores. The liquidation sales started this weekend at 200 locations, including New York City, Chicago, and right here in Washington, D.C., where locals lined up for deep discounts.
When I came around the corner and saw the Everything Must Go sign, it was just a punch in the gut.
I didn't know that the stores were closing, and then I saw the sign saying Everything Must Go. So we jaywalked across the street to come over here because we were like, oh my gosh.
Sorry, I'm out of business. I'm not at your service anymore.
It's really unfortunate that in times like this, especially with electronic books, that places like this have really gone on the wayside.
I think it makes sense. I mean, if you're not a step ahead, you're going to go down. I mean, that's expected.
For me, and for I think a lot of other people like me, this is really our book home where we can come and time disappears. This was my sanctuary for a long time, and now it's going away.
Now since I thought it over, and I made up my mind, it's plain to see I'm slipping, so I'm leaving you behind.
I do shop online, but it's nothing like holding a book in your hands.
Flipping through the pages, it's a good feeling. I don't think I'm going to be a convert to a Kindle anytime soon.
I have a shopping bag to carry it all home. I think I need a wagon today, probably.
Yes, I'm sorry, I'm out of business. Get your work done where you got it done before.
Just a few of the voices from today's liquidation sale at Borders Books and Music location in Washington, D.C. 200 stores will be closing their doors by the end of April.
The mantra sung by Gloria Gaynor is one that is running through many of our heads at this time of year. We know spring is coming, but Old Man Winter is not finished with us yet. The northern plains and upper Midwest are getting hit hard with heavy snow and ice again. Stormy weather continues out west, and wicked winds with gusts measured as high as 60 miles per hour were battering the northeast this weekend. In Washington, D.C., today's forecast calls for a partly cloudy day in the low 50s, and there are small harbingers of spring here. I saw landscapers with pallets of pansies ready to be planted in front of a posh hotel. Some of the trees now sport a slight smudge of new growth on their branches. The winter jasmine is in bloom. Reasons to keep the hopes of a warmer, more pleasant weather alive. Gardeners know all too well the doldrums of late winter. They read seed catalogs and sketch out plots for new plants. And when pictures of flowers and vegetables aren't enough to chase the blues away, they are saved by home and garden shows. Although the major ones don't open until next month, there are several underway across the country this weekend. There's the 42nd Annual Home and Garden Show in Wheeling, West Virginia. Visitors to the New Jersey Flower and Garden Show in Edison can wander through gardens on Broadway, inspired by theatrical productions. There's also a Shrek rain garden for the kids. A seminar called The Buffet is Closed offers information on deer-resistant plants. In East Montgomery, Alabama, container gardening is the hot topic at the annual Home and Garden Show there. But the best bet for lifting your mood may be the Garish Garden Show in Peoria, Illinois, a show of gardening don'ts. It features several dozen gnomes, including one wearing University of Illinois attire. But the pièce de résistance, undoubtedly, is the display of 26 pink plastic flamingos. I feel better already. So what if the ground is not completely thawed? So what if I still need gloves and a hat to go outside? So what if the sun sets at dinner time? Spring will come. It's a fact. Of course, as soon as I say that, another winter blow is bound to strike before the equinox. But it's okay. I will survive. This is NPR News.
When writer Claire Dederer first stepped into a yoga studio, she was, to put it mildly, dubious about the whole experience.
The scene was the very picture of white female self-indulgence. There were no Indian people in this room, that was certain. A woman in her late 20s entered and rolled out her mat in front of us. Her thick blonde hair was cut in an expensive bob. Her outfit was black and tight. She looked as though she had been a step aerobics teacher until about 5 minutes ago. She looked like her name was Jennifer. "I am a Tosa," she said. And I thought, like hell you are, sister.
But Dederer stuck with it. Yoga appeared to be the answer to everything in her life as a hip young mother in North Seattle. She found a teacher with a down-to-earth name, Fran, but that was just the beginning of her search. Claire Dederer tells the story of her attempt to become perfect at yoga and life in her new book, Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. She joins me now from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, yoga seems to have been the thing to do when you started it. You write a very funny description of the yummy mummies of North Seattle. I wonder if you could just give us a few of the things that that you and all the other young mothers were trying to do.
Well, there was a list of rules, which kind of surprised me how stringent they were. You had to eat organic food, breastfeed your baby, well, at least till it could talk, carry your child in a sling, strollers were completely banned. Expensive wooden toys because plastic might off-gas. You had to keep your job, but it had to be part-time, and you had to worry about it. Those are a few of the rules.
And one of the cure-alls, I gather, for everything that ailed you, from, you know, back pain to occasional depression, was yoga.
That's right. Yoga was sort of a one-stop shop for everything that you needed. You could get your exercise. You could feel extremely virtuous. After all, it's exercise you do with your hands in prayer position. And you could also get a break from your house. I'd go into the studio and I would think, this is a room I will never have to clean.
But it obviously became more than that, because you hang a memoir of... Well, I don't know. This memoir goes all the way back to when you were 7 and all the way forward to the present. You hang a memoir on yoga, 23 poses.
It's true. As a literary structure, I was surprised to find that the poses were really elastic. They lent themselves to metaphor and to exploration in a way that I didn't quite expect. And yoga itself was a path for me to try to become more perfect, more virtuous, completely good.
Completely good.
Yes.
Reading the book, I get the impression that one of the reasons you needed to be completely good was that your mother was not completely good.
Right. My mom was a matron in Seattle until 1973 and happily married. And one day she went to a pig roast, a classic 70s trope, where she fell in love with a hippie 8 years her junior and ran off with him and took us with her. And our life after that was a much more chaotic and complicated, interesting, adventurous life. And adventure is great, but it's not necessarily what children want. And I started to notice that my brother and I were both very concerned with this good kind of parenting, with this sort of always only buy the organic milk. And I felt that there were dots to connect between the chaotic way that we had experienced those years of my parents breaking up and our own experience as parents, that we were saying, no, we will never create this kind of chaos in our life. We're going to follow all the rules and everything will be fine.
So, I mean, everybody spends some time trying to separate themselves from their mother. Did yoga help with that?
Well, at first, yoga reiterated a lot of the stuff that I was thinking and feeling at the time about trying to be good and trying to follow all these rules. So I sort of went to yoga expecting to be better and better and better and to improve until finally I was perfectly virtuous and I could, you know, do a transition from scorpion into chaturanga. But what I found instead was that I would sort of fall down and be a mess and sweat and pass gas and do all the crazy things our bodies do, and that it was fine. And so yoga really ended up teaching me about loosening up and getting away from some of this perfectionism.
I loved in the book, I mean, I think we ought to say that despite the obviously serious concerns that you had, that you wrote a very funny book about your life. You shopped around, among other things, for yoga teachers, and you learned a little bit about yourself from each of your yoga teachers, like the lady who told you that in your yoga practice, you just should stay within the four corners of your mat.
She said you need to husband your gaze, which I thought was a really funny phrase. Like you were, your gaze was sheep and you were the shepherd and you were keeping all the sheep very close to you. But it was good advice. Stop looking around at what everyone else is doing. Put your focus right where it is. It's probably the best piece of yoga advice I ever got. Just keep your attention within the confines of your own mat.
In the end, do you think that you found some kind of path that took you where you needed to be?
I think I found the opposite of a path. I think I stopped looking for a path. I think I started to be more content with what I had and stopped being so concerned with trying to make everything better all the time.
Do you still do yoga?
I do. Many times a week.
That is Claire Dieterer. Her new book is called Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're joined now by James Fallows of The Atlantic. This week he's in Beijing, China, working on a new book. Hello, Jim.
Linda, nice to talk to you here from the other side of the world.
We will get to China, but first, we just heard from Larry Abramson on the Wisconsin budget battle, and the battle over the federal budget now moves to the Senate. Does anything about this year's negotiations strike you as different from years past?
I think there is one way in which this is different. You know, you and I both know, and most of the listeners do too, that since politics is largely about money and where it goes and where it comes from, it's not surprising that there are so often these big showdowns about taxes and budgets and all the rest. During the Reagan era, there were very bitter fights about his tax cuts. Certainly in Bill Clinton's time, there was the one-vote margin for passing his deficit reduction plan in 1993, and then again the government shutdowns, of course, in 1995 and 1996. I think what is distinctive this time, however, is how narrow the grounds of disagreement are. We know about the 60-some billion dollars of cuts the House Republicans have just voted. Interestingly, they're only from about one-sixth of all federal spending, the so-called non-defense discretionary spending, and not about, of course, taxes at all. So when you have so much of the debate about such a small share of what the government takes and spends, it makes it a different kind of debate from what we've had before.
And it seems to me not a particularly meaningful debate, and just a sort of a lot of bluster about something that may be completely unlikely to happen.
Yes. I mean, there's the practical fact that with a still Democratic-controlled Senate and a Democrat in the White House, these cuts are very unlikely to go through in their current form. And also, I think in historical retrospect, we'll see an election campaign in 2010 that was largely dominated by talk about the deficit and this great fury of getting things passed through the House recently. But it is, again, most of what the federal government does is not touched by these proposals. And so it does seem a mismatch of energy and even vitriol and practical effects.
Now, I'm changing the subject here to technology. I know there's one technology story which obviously caught your eye this week. As a magazine person, Apple has decided to allow something called in-app subscriptions to newspapers and magazines from their mobile devices.
This is so fascinating as part of the long saga of whether journalism is going to be able to fund itself in the long run. When the iPad appeared a number of months ago, many publications thought this was kind of the holy grail because it's a way you get revenue for having online distribution or a digital distribution of your content. And Apple this week said they're going to allow publications to sell subscriptions via the iPad and similar devices, not just issue-by-issue sale. The catch was that Apple was going to take 30% of all the revenue that came in this way and also control the information about the subscribers, which for the publications would be a real challenge. So almost immediately after Apple's announcement, Google came up with a plan where it was going to only charge 10% for subscriptions sold through its Android system and also let the publishers have control over the subscriber data. So there is an interesting battle going on with, I think, real implications for how, as I said, journalism is able to get revenue in the new online age.
As I mentioned, you are in Beijing right now researching a new book. What's the news from China?
There's a lot of domestic attention on the cashiering of the man who's been in charge of China's very, very ambitious high-speed rail program, which has just blanketed the nation with these very, very fast trains. And the accusations are that a lot of safety shortcuts have been taken. The trains are running much, much faster than the Japanese say they would run trains on the same kind of tracks. There apparently has not been enough of the right kind of solidifying agent for a number of the bridges and other things that have been built. And, of course, there are monetary questions. And so while it's been important for the U.S. to look to Chinese high-speed rail as an example of what can be done, there's a lot of doubts inside China now about what actually has been done.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda. My pleasure.